Welcome. It's Thursday night and time for Psychic Viewpoint on PsychicAccessTalkRadio.com. Spirituality, psychic development, love and relationships, manifesting prosperity, and more. You now have access to the world's most renowned spiritual teachers, healers, psychics, and mediums as you join us during this transpersonal collective experience. Sponsored by PsychicAccess.com, where all psychics have been interviewed, verified, and accuracy tested, assuring you the highest quality of quality service. And now, on with this week's show.
Hello, friends. My name is Stephen Lewis, and you are listening to The Psychic Viewpoint, sponsored by PsychicAccess.com. In a moment, Anita Burns, NLP practitioner and trainer, master hypnotherapist, handwriting analyst, and clinical psychologist, will join Dr. Nona Marie Foyer to talk about the soul map. But
I will continue to talk about her a little bit till we get her more online.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about this soul map thing and how Anita fits into the context of soul mapping.
Yes, I don't want to mess it up, you know, because she is the expert. But she, as a child, she already had a deep connection and with spirit. And later on in life, she began to have spiritual transmissions through her guides, Michael and Johar and Simon.
Are you there? Well, you know what, Dr. Nona Marie? She is here.
Anita, are you here?
I am. Hi.
There you are. I was being put on the spot here to talk about soul mapping.
I heard.
I was like, Anita's the expert here. So glad to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So explain to us, if you would, first of all, we want to hear a little bit about how you met your universal group mind, Michael, Johar, Simon, and what actually happened to bring soul mapping forward and then telling us what it is, if you would.
Sure. Well, first of all, Michael is not a part of the group. He's just Michael is an archangel that I channel sometimes. Okay. Johar and Simon are a part of my soul group.
Mm-hmm. And I understand now. Okay.
Okay. And they're not my guides. Guides are something different. How I came about, how I discovered soul mapping or soul groups was in the 1970s. I was at sort of a crossroads in my life spiritually. I see this in a lot of my students where you read so many things that are contradictory. You don't know which way to go. You don't know what makes sense. And there always seem to be more questions than answers. So I stumbled upon, you know how that is, how you stumble upon things that are really meant to be. I stumbled upon a book called Messages from Michael. Messages from Michael by Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, and I believe it's been reprinted lately, if anyone is interested. I'm sure it's on Amazon somewhere. And the spirit medium was bringing through an entity called Michael, not the archangel, but a different Michael, who laid out how the whole thing worked in such a logical, explainable fashion that I went, wow, this answers almost all my questions. And I add almost because I know if I said all my questions, one would come up. So it made so much sense to me. And so I started studying it a little bit, plan, or I don't know what you would really call it, a system that Michael was putting forth about how we came to be here, what it's all about, and where we're going. Mm-hmm. And then some years later, I mean, many, many years later, I tried to become a channel, a spirit channel, and I failed miserably. I went to classes, I took private courses, I tried and tried and tried, and nothing, absolutely nothing happened. So I finally just gave up. And then one day, One day while I was riding in the car in Texas from Houston to Fredericksburg. And if you've ever been in Texas, you know there's a lot of in-between there. There's Houston goes, Houston-Fredericksburg goes through the LBJ Ranch, which is a long, straight road with undulating hills. And I must, it was kind of twilight or getting dark, and I must have gone into some kind of trance state. And I had been a practicing medium, not medium, a practicing psychic, so I wasn't, you know, unfamiliar with altered states. I'm also a you know, licensed hypnotherapist and psychologist and so forth. So I wasn't afraid of what was going on because I felt kind of buzzy. And then these words started pouring out of my mouth, talking to the driver, who was now my ex-husband, was my husband at the time, about his relationship with his father and his karma and all kinds of stuff. And I'm thinking, how the hell is, who's talking here? You know, who's saying this stuff? I was so excited. When we got back home, it was David who helped me to hone my skill, to learn to control it, to learn to be a spirit, a channel. And I was too stupid in those days to realize that it was what I was doing was dangerous. I would just go into this altered state of consciousness and say, "Who's there?" You know, no protection or anything.
Right.
Fortunately, I must have some kind of guardian angel. And it got to be when I realized that I had sometimes done some things that might have been really dangerous for me, I asked for one voice to come through, one entity to come through and be a guardian for anything else. And that turned out to be Johar. And Johar told me that I was a part of their soul group, but that I had not advanced enough to not be on Earth anymore. So I'm the laggard, and I'm a slow learner. And he was just delightful. And he's wise, and he's kind, and he's has the most amazing knowledge of any being I've ever encountered. And then later on, I maybe 6 or maybe 10 years later, another voice came through, also from my soul group, and said his name was Simon. And Simon is dynamic and boisterous and has a good sense of humor, and so they're kind of opposite personalities, but they say they're both a part of my soul group. And they started talking about the soul mapping. And when they started talking about the soul mapping, I said, "This sounds a lot like the Michael teachings." And he said, you know, and Simon, who has a good sense of humor, says, "Oh, yeah, we know Simon. We know Michael." He's not in our soul group, but, you know, somehow there's some connection. So he confirmed that most of what I had been reading was, according to them, correct. And I went, "Wow, that's good." When I go into trance to channel, I go into a delta state, so I don't remember anything. I'm not aware of what's being said at all. I have to listen to the recordings afterwards. So what he says, in a nutshell, and I assume you're interested in that, is that we start off as what they call virgin spirit, unaware of our divinity, just are completely unaware. And that we incarnate into first the mineral kingdom, like this unaware, asleep spirit or soul matter, or what I call virgin matter from the primal soup. Inhabits crystals and minerals and stones and everything in the mineral kingdom. But what happens when we embody in the physical is that we begin to grow in consciousness. And when we grow in consciousness to such a point that we can no longer be contained by the mineral, then we move into plant. I want to back up a second because I missed a step here. When we come out of the virgin soup, of the virgin divine consciousness, we split up into 1,000 sparks of light, according to Michael and Johar and Simon. And we each individually incarnate from that. As we move up through the kingdoms, mineral, plant, plant, animal, animal, human, then we start a voyage of true awakening. And we start off as what's called an infant soul. And infant souls are those who are very barely aware of their spiritual dynamic. So infant souls you can usually recognize because they're afraid of everything. They live in very small, close-knit groups, usually very comfortable in fundamentalist religions, very simple lives. I don't want to typify any person, but they're pretty recognizable. Also, they're very afraid of germs, germophobic. Mm. That doesn't mean that every germaphobe is an infant soul. It's just that that's one of the prevailing characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
And we go through 7 levels of this infant soul growth where we gradually awaken a little bit more, and then we incarnate into what's called a baby soul. And baby souls are like infants. They're very aware of themselves, but everything is related to themselves. They like structure. They like rules, law and order. They generally live very orderly lives. They like the courts. In other words, a lot of people who do a lot of lawsuits often are baby souls. But they're not able to be comfortable in a looser environment or a looser way of living. Often baby souls congregate in small towns. They like to be sheriffs, police officers, that kind of thing, in small towns, preachers. Everything is very fundamental, black and white, cut and dried. They don't question authority. And they absolutely trust medical professionals generally. Now, keep in mind, these are real generalized right now. There are things called overleaves that make it more individualized and personal.
Mm-hmm.
Baby souls have an abundance of shoulds. You know, I think my brother was a baby soul, because baby souls experience the world through their filter and their filter only. And they mm-hmm. think that everyone else is or should, or does or should, think like they do. Example, my brother and I were not close. And one day he called me up when I was in my 20s, that was a very long time ago. And he said, you know, sis, we've never really been close. Maybe we should get to know each other better. Why don't we go out sometime and have some fun? So I thought, you know, I never really liked him in the first place, but okay. And I said, so what do you want to do? He says, oh, let's go out to the desert and shoot rats. Mm. And I went, what? I said, Stan, that's not really my idea of fun. And his answer was, sure it is. That's fun. Don't you know what fun is? That's a baby soul attitude.
Right.
Then, fortunately, we don't stay in there forever. Then we move into what's called young souls. And young souls are the movers and shakers of the world. They're like teenagers. They're like out there, that kind of attitude of adventure, invention, moving up the ladder of the corporation, competition. Their motto might be, he who dies with the most toys wins. Hmm. And thank goodness for young souls, because otherwise, if it weren't for them, we probably wouldn't be able to be talking in this way, because they are the innovators and inventors. They're also rabid workers for a cause, people who picket, people who go after making the world better, or really, really work for a cause. Greenpeace comes to mind. A lot of young souls in Greenpeace, because they're out there doing it because they believe in something, they're going to go for it. And then we go into what are called mature souls. Excuse me. Mature souls are the artists, philosophers, thinkers, people who suffer for their art, actors and so forth. It's not all actors are young souls. Remember, these are just generalizations. I mean, not young souls, I mean mature souls. The thing about mature souls is they're starting to feel their divine consciousness, but they don't really know what to do with it yet. So they express it through art, writing, poetry, painting, dance, acting, music. And this is a way for them to express those deep feelings that they're getting, but don't really understand yet. They often will suffer greatly because they're seeking answers and have a hard time getting them. A really good example of a young soul would be Vincent van Gogh, who had horrible problems. Also, Salvador Dali, Andy Warhol, are typical young souls. Now, I can't verify they were, but they typify the characteristics of a mature soul. I keep saying young, but I mean mature. Then after we have moved out of that, then we move into what are called old souls. And probably anyone listening to this show would be an old soul, because old souls are in their quest to understand, to reconnect with their soul group, to move beyond the physical senses, to experience spirit, to experience divine consciousness. Those are the old souls. And the only problem that you get with an old soul cycle is that depression is very common. It's kind of been there, done that, is that all there is attitude until they get a spark of something and then they go for it and they're all excited. Old souls are in the cycles of karma resolution too, so old souls often have difficult lives. But on the good side, old souls kind of step back and they don't get all, get their panties in a bunch about little things. They just it's they're more tolerant, forgiving, live and let live, that kind of thing. And so that's the nice part about it, is you just don't give a rat's behind about a lot of things that the mature and young souls do. Let's see, what else did I leave? Did I leave out anything? Oh yeah, the education, whereas from young mature and young souls always go for the PhD, the higher education. Old souls don't really care. If they get higher education, it's for a definite purpose, not just to have, just because it's something they think they should do. Young souls like exotic animals. They have food fetishes. They're really interesting people. Old souls, not so much. Old souls like big fluffy dogs and cats and, things like that. They probably wouldn't be as interested in having a boa constrictor, but, to each his own. So that's the soul levels, but it goes so much beyond that. Then we have what are called soul rays. Soul rays are what your spark is, an essence that your spark has taken on for your entire journey through lifetimes. And it's each of your sparks, you might have some that have the same soul ray that you do, but there are seven soul rays. And I don't know how we choose this, that's so there is a question still, but somehow we are assigned or choose a soul ray. And the soul ray is something like a deep core essence that we carry around with us throughout every lifetime. And there are seven. There's sage, artisan, priest, server, king, warrior, and scholar. And this doesn't have anything to do with occupation. For example, Queen Victoria was a server soul. Server souls are live their lives to serve others. They're not comfortable unless they're helping others or being of service in some way. My grandmother was a server soul for sure. When her third husband died, she said she was looking for a fourth because she just didn't feel right unless she had somebody to take care of. She was a kind and wonderful soul. And so server souls are there to take care of people. And there's a positive and a negative energy that we can slide in and out of. For example, the server soul positive energy is service. The server soul negative energy is bondage. And how we get into one or the other is probably beyond the scope of the time we have. Sage souls, for example, sage souls are orators, expressors. They're very dramatic, very colorful. They think they are very wise and philosophical, and they love art and beauty and so forth. They're very dramatic in their speech. They act things out. Their lives, because of this, are often like full of trauma, almost a soap opera life sometimes. Like I have a friend who has sort of disappeared off the face of the earth, one of the most incredible palmists I've ever met, Linda, called me once and she said this litany of woes. And I said, Linda, if a rock was falling from the heavens, it would find your head. But otherwise, she was very much like a sage. Then we have scholars. Scholars, well, first of all, sages, if they learn something, they have to let you know or they teach it. A scholar just learns for knowledge, seeks knowledge for knowledge's sake. They're a big repository for trivia, statistics, facts and figures. They have broad interests. They're not comfortable in confined learning paths. They have to know everything there is to know about everything. It's almost ADD. They're pretty scientific, kind of aloof, a bit neutral sometimes. Then we have what's called the warriors. I know a lot of warriors. Warriors experience life as a series of challenges to overcome. Nothing stops a warrior. A bit like an Aries.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. They're very good. They're not very good at invention, but warriors are very good at taking other people's ideas and making them better. Mm. And Thomas Edison, for example, none of his ideas were his own, but he sure made them better. Warriors are really good salespeople. They don't take no for an answer. I love warriors. I was taking a group out to somewhere in the desert that has a lot of, I can't remember the name of the place, but it has a lot of lava that's been formed into big eddies by a river that's no longer there. And so we were taking this and we were going to go down into the valley to collect shards of obsidian. And I was going to go around the long way through the path, right? And mm-hmm. our warrior soul in it said, nah, let's just climb straight down the mountain. So we did. She just led the charge. She wasn't going to let a little thing like that stop her. She's just lovely. Then we have artisan souls. I mean, that kind of says it right there. They're very creative. They're very artistic. They're very good at mechanical things, too. They're priests. Priests are kind of like servers, but whereas servers want to serve you from the bottom up, priests want to gather you around them so they can teach you from the top down, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, they want to bring out the potential in others. They're also very good, you know, managers and so forth. Let's see, who am I missing? Scholar. Scholars, I think I said, are information gatherers. They don't care if they share it. They just want the knowledge. And king. The last one I think is king. Kings are very rare. We don't have very many what Michael called magnetic kings in the world because, I mean, look, think about it. The world needs more servers than it needs kings. Mm-hmm. But you know a king when you meet one. They have their natural leaders. They know what needs to be done. They're very charismatic. No challenge is left laying. They go for it, kind of like a warrior does. But a king will find other people to do the work for them and organize, whereas a warrior just charges ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember if it was Johar or Simon said that President Kennedy was a king mm-hmm. soul. So no matter how he screwed up, people loved him anyway.
Right.
Because they looked at him and they felt this king ray. So that's it in a nutshell. We do have what are called overleaves, and those get pretty involved. I can go over them quickly if you like.
Sure.
Okay. Overleaves are the things that we take on each lifetime differently. Overleafs can change during a lifetime also. You can work out whatever it is. If there's an overleaf that's challenging, you can work it out and it can change, whereas soul ray does not change. But we have what are called goals, and those are primary our motivators within a lifetime. It's why we do things. And then we have what are called modes. Modes are a way that we view life. So those can be conflicting sometimes, but usually they're in line with each other. And then we have goals, and there are seven goals. Oh, excuse me, I forgot attitudes. There's an attitude. No, I said that one, didn't I? Then we have goals, and goals are how we go about making all this happen. And there's a goal of acceptance where we just kind of lay back and we accept the way people are. And, you know, it's just pretty self-explanatory, acceptance. But then sometimes we have, and it's acceptance of ourselves too. Then sometimes we have a goal of rejection. And you know people who just keep putting themselves in situations where you know they're going to be rejected or they're going to fail or they're going to be blocked or something's going to happen. But they just keep doing it. Then there's a goal of growth. It's about as experiencing as much as you can in one life. You know, go out and climb a mountain and learn opera. You know, everything you possibly can experience in life is about growth. And these take on different flavors depending on your soul ray and your soul age. A goal of growth, for example, would be very different for a young soul than it would be for an old soul. Then we have reevaluation, and reevaluation. If you have an overleaf of a reevaluation, it's about self-discovery. We want to experience life, but our main goal is to understand who we are and to dissolve karma. Whether we're aware we've got karma or not, we'll take ourselves in places that will help us face it. Then we have a role of dominance, and that's pretty self-explanatory. And then we have a role of submission, and that's pretty explanatory. Submission is also, though, about becoming effective in useful ways. But they don't lead the pack. Even if they're like a warrior soul. A warrior soul with a goal of submission is a real conflict. Then we have equilibrium, which is learning to let go with the flow, enjoy, kind of let things happen as they happen. And these, again, are just really simple explanations. And then the seven modes are power, caution, passion. I'm reading the list now. Reserve, aggression, perseverance, observation. Seven attitudes are spiritualist, skeptic, idealist, cynic, realist, and pragmatist. Then we have things that are centers, or high centers and low centers. Then we have things called parts and traps. So it gets pretty involved. But once you get your pattern down, boy, you really know yourself. And you know how to move through life in a really effective and empowered way. The only thing that really gets in our way, though, is a thing called a chief feature or a chief obstacle. Michael called it a chief feature. Johar and Simon called it a chief obstacle. Same, pretty much the same thing. Those are the things that we take on sometimes to really make us learn certain lessons. And there's self-deprecation, which is, I'm unworthy. Then there's arrogance. There's self-destruction. I've known several people with that one. And there's greed, martyrdom, impatience, and stubbornness. Mine was stubbornness for a long time. Boy, it took me a long time to get over that one. And then I realized I also had impatience. So I've pretty much worked on that, although it fires up, it raises its ugly head every once in a while. Like today when I was trying to get back here by 5 o'clock. So, like I said, these can be gone into and really, really, there's a lot more detail to it. But when this puzzle piece fit together and I figured out where I was and I started helping others figure out where they were, a whole new world opened up. It was just astounding and amazing. So that's it. Briefly, what else would you like to know?
So I have some questions.
Sure. Great.
First of all, do the souls, like say we come in, however, as a young, a mature, an old soul, do they then, before we come in, do they pick their overleaf? Do they pick their modes, attitudes, and goals? Is that all determined before a soul incarnates? And
well,
if so, how is that decided? Like, how does that all get set up before someone comes in? And if it isn't, how does it get into place?
Good questions. Yeah. Well, it depends. Of course, young, babies, infant and baby souls are not aware enough between lives to pick their own stuff. Once they reach the late baby soul stage or the young souls, they're kind of aware and they can pick certain things. And you don't really get into real detail about your next life until you hit the mature soul stage. Before that, they're picked for you by what are called transcendental souls, which are souls that are living out their cycles out of the body, not in the body. Sometimes people will call them masters, or I think some group calls them brotherhoods of light. Every group has a different name for them, but they're high consciousness beings who don't have to incarnate again. And some of them have the job of helping people pick or choose their oversouls or their overleaves.
So in other words, this is set up before a soul comes in, but some of it for younger souls, it's set up with, say, guidance. But then when you get to be an older soul, you might set this all up before you come in?
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And so this reminds me a little bit. I wanted to know if what you thought of this. Carolyn Mace, who does the archetypes, this reminds me a little bit of that. Do you see a relationship between these different soul types in her work and her whole concept of sacred contracts and things? It sounds to me like almost the same kind of information just presented quite differently, but I might have that all wrong. So I wanted to get your impression of that.
Well, you know, I see this in a lot of things. I'm not intimately familiar with Carolyn Mace's work. I have a great deal of respect for her, and I have read some of her material. But it sounds to me like, yeah, that there's a definite connection.
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with her stuff either. I love her work. But as you were talking, it came to me because she talks about the sacred contracts that we set up before we come in here. And she does talk about these archetypes, and they were very much matching what you were talking about with soul rays. So,
I find it in so many places under just different names.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, there's synchronicity there. There's the same information being presented in slightly different language, and sometimes we can hear the same information from one person and not another one. So I'm glad that you kind of see that as well. I guess I wanted to know, how do you, if you're doing soul mapping for someone, first of all, two questions, how do you do it? And how much information can you give someone at one time, particularly if they're like a young soul or a baby soul? So how do you use this information?
Well, first of all, a young soul and a baby soul wouldn't be interested.
Okay.
And a baby soul, you know, might burn a cross on my lawn, or pray for me till their knees are bloody. I know that's not politically correct to say, but, you know, so sorry. No, I'm not sorry.
<It's> still funny.
I get a lot of mature souls, late level mature souls, because we stay in these cycles for sometimes, you know, hundreds of lives, depending on how quickly we learn. And we go through seven levels in each cycle. So I get a lot of late level mature souls and a lot of old souls. And depending on how much time they want to spend, I can give them as much information as possible. I do it by through channeling. I do it by, through asking them questions. In my book, there's a little quiz at the back of each section you can take to kind of get an idea about where you are. But it's hard to be objective about yourself. So even after that, I get a lot of people coming with their answers and asking me to clarify it. And so I can give them every little bit of information if they're interested in doing that. Usually they just want the overview, though. Mm-hmm. And I also teach it sometimes. Once in a while, I'll hold a course in soul mapping, and it's pretty lengthy. It's sometimes, or not sometimes, I can do it in 9 weeks, but usually it's 12 weeks.
Wow. And in that course, what are you teaching? Are you teaching how to determine soul mapping, or mm-hmm. are you also teaching tools on how to handle the different choices a soul has made? What
yeah.
do you cover?
All of the above.
So what are some examples? Like, let's say people get some information from you about their soul and how everything's constructed. How can they use that? And how do you help them if they're stuck?
Well, I'm an NLP practitioner, so I use NLP to help them if they're stuck.
Okay. Can you give an example of that when you say that? Not everybody listening will understand NLP and
neuro-linguistic programming.
Yeah. So
it's kind of a map of the mind, the way this is a map of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, if people are stuck in, let's say, a conflicting overleaf, mm-hmm. what we can do is go in and do what's called a reframing, or even sometimes a thing called collapsing anchors, or a timeline therapy. There are a lot of tools that can help someone work through that maze and release some of the conflicts. And it's not that they're releasing the conflicts, they're learning to use the overleaves in a out of the positive pole rather than the negative pole, so that it works for them instead of against them.
Can you give an example of a specific example, like an overleaf, and how somebody might look at it negatively, and then how they could flip it to look at the same thing positively?
Oh, good question. Let me think for a second here. Well, let's say someone has a chief obstacle of self-deprecation,
mm-hmm.
and yet they are a warrior soul.
Mm-hmm.
They can learn to come to center with that, and instead of having it self-deprecation, they can have it as humility
mm-hmm.
and understanding about what limitations they really do have and understanding what limitations they don't have.
Mm.
So they don't just automatically go for, I am the best, and have a big S on their chest. You know,
right.
they don't go try out for American Idol wearing a dolphin costume. You know?
Right.
So they understand more about what the positive pole of self-deprecation could be,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and how to use it in a positive way.
Right. So in other words, in this example you're giving, it might be a way for a warrior soul to find a little better balance than mm-hmm. being headstrong and running into a wall at 180 miles an hour. They might be able to take
right.
a slightly more moderate approach to a challenge.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. I like that. So, and then you say also that the overleafs can change. So why do they change, or how do they change? And here's a question really behind that too is, do we plan to advance a certain amount in a lifetime, or we just kind of cross our fingers and hope for it? In other words, do we say, I want to go through these three overleafs in this uh-huh. lifetime and have them change, or is it kind of a crapshoot in that area?
Well, you know, I think was it Einstein that said life happens while you're making plans?
Right. And as my friends say, we make plans and God laughs. So.
Exactly. Well, that's kind of what it is. And okay. overleafs can change, but they don't usually change.
Okay.
It's very possible. I mean, it's possible, but it's real hard work to learn whatever lesson we've decided to learn or whatever challenge we've decided to meet in one lifetime with those overleafs. But once we do that and they're no longer needed, then they can fall away and move into a positive pole or move on to something else. It's not very common that they change. What changes most quickly is the chief obstacle.
Explain that more, please, if you would.
The chief obstacle is a resistance. It's something that we put in our way. It is an obstacle in life. So if we have a goal of growth and we have a chief obstacle of stubbornness, we might stubbornly continue on beating our heads against a wall. And once we realize to step back and evaluate more, then that stubbornness can go away, and then we can progress more readily.
And so is there then, how do we know, like, we graduated the class? In other words,
you know, you do know.
And...
I don't know how to explain it, but you know.
Okay.
What kind of example can I give you for that? All right. It's not relating exactly, but it's kind of related. As I was growing up, my father and I had a very tumultuous relationship, and I blamed him for everything that went wrong in my life. And I always just had horrible feelings about him. And he wasn't abusive or anything. He was verbally abusive, and he was an alcoholic, and, you know, it was just really, really tumultuous. Mm-hmm. And after he died, every medium I went to would say, "Your father is here. He wants you to forgive him." And I thought I had forgiven him. I really did. I didn't think about him. I just kind of let it go. I pushed in the back and I would say, "You know, I forgive you. Go away. Don't bug me." But he kept coming back and kept coming back. And then one day, again, while I was riding in the car, there's a pattern here. Something just washed over me, and I felt this weight lift up out of me and dissolve. And suddenly, I experienced my father in a whole different way. Mm. I truly understood from the inside out that he did the best he could do, and that he was not a bad person, and that he didn't hate me, and that my childhood was not as bad as I had built it up in my mind. And it was a feeling. You know it. You feel it.
Great example. That's a great example. I like
that
a lot.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So what about this concept? I've done some life between life regressions, and I love this book, The Education of Oversoul 7, that comes out.
Oh, my favorite book.
I'm so glad you love that. That book cracks me up.
Oh, my
trilogy, and I love it. I just love that book. Still, decades later.
Yeah.
So how does it relate to the fact that I do believe that we're not really having past lives, but we're having simultaneous lives, and that sometimes we're also part of us, if we're maybe an older soul or a mature soul, is working in different dimensions, doing other projects while we're still here on Earth incarnated. In other words, so we're not here 100% and we are running simultaneous lives. How does soul mapping fit in there, and how does that help? Because, like in Oversoul 7, it'll talk about, like, something's happening in one life and it ripples through the hologram and has an effect on the other lives. And I'm wondering if soul mapping helps to tie those together, or is a tool in any way for people who understand that we are living a couple of or many different lives at one time, plus maybe doing intergalactic work.
Okay, wow. Good question. Let's see if I can answer it. Probably not. The thing is that is the big conundrum, isn't it? Because we are only allowed to be aware of one existence at a time,
right?
Unless we have, and when we go into hypnotic work or between life work and so forth, we may get a glimpse, but we're never really allowed to live consciously more than one at a time.
Well, it's at least not outside of an institution, right?
Right, exactly. And then they give you medication.
Exactly.
One of my spiritual teachers, Baba Sri Shiva, I think it was, or Muktananda, I don't remember which one, said that we live our lives as if we are a cat walking on a ledge behind a picket fence. Mm-hmm. And the only thing we can see as we walk along are tiny little glimpses between the pickets.
Oh, I love that. Great description.
Oh, yeah. I loved
Great
it too.
description.
That's why it stuck in my head. And so somehow I believe that this does work with that too, but I don't have an answer. I'm just going, yeah, I bet it does.
Right. That's so interesting. Wow. I love that. So, have you ever had somebody, do you ever meet people where they're so far off their soul map that you kind of go, gee, I wonder what happened. Like, did they get in a train wreck or something? And have you met those people? Then how do you help them get back on that track?
Well, I've never met anybody like that because we live our soul map regardless.
Okay.
We just live it. Whether we're conscious of it, whether we let it drive us crazy, or whether we love it, it's who we are. The only time that, even when we interfere with where we're supposed to be going, we're still doing it through our filters of who we are.
Right. That's so interesting because sometimes I've run into people and it seems like we do have a lot of free will to like jump ship, you know, just say, screw it. You know, I made this plan. I'm not doing it. And I've met a few people like that. And I have seen them turn around once they kind of realize that there was sort of a like a cruise ship going along and they had jumped ship and they're swimming in the water and they don't have to do that. Like the ship is right there, you know, paralleling you and you're just doing, you know, you kind of made this left turn. So have you run into something like that?
Sure, absolutely. But the reasons they jumped ship and how they're swimming in the water still seems to reflect their soul ray and their overleaves and their chief obstacle.
Right, got it. So have you been able to use soul mapping with people like that to help them climb back on board and not have to work so hard to get to the same place?
I have. It's not always a quick fix.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely. It's once people understand and realize what they're made of. And the thing that's the thing about neurolinguistic programming also is you understand how you work, how you're wired together. Right. So I kind of call the soul mapping the NLP of spirituality. It helps you understand what wires go where, how your neurons are firing, what your belief map is. And it also, like soul mapping, helps you understand that the map is not the territory. That's a saying by a wonderful philosopher named Alfred Korzybski. This map is not the territory means what we believe is real isn't the real thing. It's just a representation of reality.
And how is that helpful to people, that concept?
Because we get out of ourselves. We realize that just because we believe that fire engines should be red doesn't make it so.
Okay, right.
Or we believe that we may believe that our neighbor is an alien, but it doesn't mean it's true. No matter how.
Well, if you're a warrior talking with a to lot my of mother. Stubbornness, that's a hard conversation.
I remember talking to my mother, who was
emotional
very...
freedom therapy, and as a tool for things like soul mapping or corrective action for soul mapping issues.
Yeah. EFT? You're talking about EFT?
Yeah. Do you like EFT? Have you used that at all?
I've heard a couple of people say it really worked for them, but I've never met them. Only people I've ever met said it didn't work for them.
Yeah.
It didn't work for me. So I'm leaving it out that it works for some people and not for others.
Yeah. I've heard mixed reviews about it too. There's a couple of people that have done it, do it very well in a way that kind of processes through a lot of knots. Reminds me sort of R.D. Lang's book, Knot. Uh-huh. This woman, Pat Carrington, another one named Karen Davies, that they do it quite differently. They kind of just keep tapping through all the self-talk until they come out the other end. And it seems to.
Oh God, that's a lot of work. NLP is so much faster.
So what else do you use besides NLP to help people get more, I don't know, give them more tools to work with their soul map?
Well, I use a thing called Inner Guide Meditation that was a system that was begun by Dr. Carl Jung. And changed a little or adapted a little bit by a man named Edwin Steinbrecher so that people could use it outside of a therapeutic arena. It's an incredibly powerful tool for understanding yourself. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Carl Jung's work.
A little bit, yes.
A little bit? Okay. He used tarot cards a lot for therapy, therapeutic means. And he devised a system where he would take you into a very, very deep, deep state of consciousness where you would meet what's called your inner guide. And that inner guide would introduce you to the archetypes that are within us all in the guise of tarot cards. And what Jung and Steinbrecher did was they would take your horoscope and translate it into the tarot archetypes.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. So I use that. And I also teach inner guide meditation. It's wonderful. And then I also use Ericksonian hypnosis.
Oh, wonderful.
I have a pretty big toolbox.
Yeah. I love Ericksonian hypnosis. Very few people even know what that is anymore, it seems like.
I know, and it's so sad because it's amazingly powerful.
It's amazing, amazing, amazing. But I also think not a lot of people can do that kind of work because you have to be highly intuitive, it seems to me. Am I wrong in that?
No, you don't have to be highly intuitive. You have to be highly observant. I spent 8 years learning this stuff, so it's not easy. You can't just pick up a book and do it. It really takes a lot of training and a lot of determination to learn how to rewire your mind and your consciousness to be able to be that kind of observant.
Mm. That is fantastic. Yeah, his work is just phenomenal. And every time I read about him and how he's handled cases, it just kind of astounds me. It seems to me beyond observation, but that's very...
Well, it might be. I don't know. Since I've been psychic since I was born, maybe I had some of that.
Right. For you, but, right. There's a level of observation that a lot of normal therapists could not, psychotherapists could not get to. And I know I've met a lot of people who are so frustrated with mainstream therapy because there's just so many therapists that are book learned, but they are not intuitive or they haven't worked on themselves and they don't have a spiritual aspect to therapy. So
that's so true. That is so true. Yeah. I feel it a lot. Sometimes I call on Erickson to help me. I say, Uncle Milty, please. I'm stuck. Right. And then the answer comes.
I so wish that mainstream therapy, there was more available for people who wanted to go into therapy to call in spiritual tools and not be considered weird, and wacky. Yeah. I mean, there's a very few places that I know. So,
tell me about it. My degree is in clinical psychology. And when I worked at a clinic for a while, I was told to leave my voodoo home.
I believe it. Well, we have run out of time, and I just could talk to you all night, so we're going to end the show, and I want to thank you a million times for making time for this, which is fascinating and truly an honor to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. I had a great time.
Me
I appreciate
too. I'll
you
be
having
in touch.
Me.
Thank Bye-bye. You, Anita. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Anita.
Thank you.
From you. Incidentally, if you own a website, you can earn 50 cents per minute for every reading on traffic that is referred from your site to psychicaccess.com. For more details, visit psychicaccess.com/webmasters. Since you love the show so much, we'd like you to keep us in mind and be on the lookout for when we reemerge later in the summer. We're going to have probably the chat room function there. So let your friends know and stay on the lookout for Psychic Viewpoint. Take the opportunity to go through our extensive archives on the site, psychicaccesstalkradio.com, and catch up on all the wonderful stuff that we have been up to over the years. And we will definitely be back at the end of the summer, early autumn. So that's all I've got for now, Dr. Nona Marie. I'm handing it over to you.
Oh, I am breathless from talking to Anita Burns, just a wealth of information, and I love the soul mapping material. The problem I have when I have guests like this is I immediately want to go and stay with them, pick their brains, watch them work. So, Stephen, tell me, have you heard of soul mapping, and are you familiar with Carolyn Mace's archetypes, and is this all kind of new material?
Well, yes and no, let's just say. I haven't really heard it called soul mapping. It has a different nomenclature. Mm-hmm. But it's still a very provocative system or theory or whatever you'd like to call it. The only thing that I would caution against is this idea that one, you know, would stratify the soul. I think that you know, the Hindus did it for a while, and I think they're trying to get away from that. And I think it's going to take Hinduism probably several centuries before it can divest itself fully of the caste system. And mm-hmm. a lot of these systems, to me, that seems to be their chiefest fear. For example, the one thing I'd worry about is that if it fell into the hands of someone who didn't know what they were doing, then guess what? Guess who the baby soul is going to be?
Right.
Everybody you don't like. For example, that could include, you know, let's say you don't like the people who decide to worship God by falling down on their knees. Or
right.
Let's say you don't like Scientologists. Or let's say you don't like Jehovah's Witnesses or whatever. Now, guess what? You have a convenient way of labeling them as baby souls. And your soul, by implication, is of a higher grade. You know,
yeah.
So that's the danger I think people should watch out for. But if they can get past that and use the system objectively, then I think it's really helpful in putting you in a framework of spiritual frameworks so that you know how you can fit into the cosmos.
Well, it does seem to me also, though, that a lot of the same information can be pulled out from using an astrological chart. Is that
sure.
not true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
So in that sense, I felt right at home hearing her explain this new concept because, you know, for example, the seven different classifications for various things, you know, immediately it sprung to mind, oh, okay, the seven traditional planets, you know, and I thought that was really, really
right.
neat. Of course, you know, being biased as I am toward astrology, you know, and plus being knowledgeable about astrology a lot more, I can talk about that more intelligently.
Right.
Anita's system is very complex, seems to me quite powerful, and something I would like to learn more about and read up on more.
Well, I think astrology is the same way. You know, it's powerful and complex. And even things she was talking about, goals and obstacles, to me, isn't that related to North Node and South Node and looking at transits that we have?
Sure, and you know, astrology does a lot of the same things that I spent so much time sermonizing about. You know, mm-hmm. part of the point is to stratify people into different categories, or at least I don't know if that's the point, but it sometimes happens that way in
mm-hmm.
interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for modern psychological exegesis and explorations. And, you know, using various doctrines of archetypes propounded by thinkers throughout the past century, then, you know, it's an outstanding tool. I mean, you can use these categorizations to diagnose your problems, and when used objectively, very, very powerful stuff. But astrology carries the same potential for abuse if you're not careful, in the sense that it can deepen one's delusions.
Right. But I think that's true of all systems. It's like
certainly is.
Talking about guns and knives. They're tools and they're weapons, and they can be abused or used. So I find that's true with numerology as my favorite tool.
Well,
and I love astrology, but I've never just really learned enough to be very good at it. But I think they can all be abused and also all be excellent. So that's a very good point you brought up about that.
Well, I just want to add that the good thing about these systems, especially astrology, it sort of acts like a polygraph, you know, like a graph system with a stylus. In other words, there's a readout. You know, there's this astrology, we can plot the positions of the planets and at least, you know, point to something and look at it. For example, also like the price action of various securities on the market. You know, you look at the graph line, what you're looking at is a symbol of human psychology. You're looking at symbols of fear conflicting with symbols of greed. You know, so in what my point is that with astrology and other tools of psychological analysis, they can very often give us tangible charts and things where, you know, we can have a record of these ideas and analyze them. And I found that to be probably the most helpful thing of all. When you try to place a system of rules on things, then meaning sort of emerges out of that on its own.
Yes, I got it. So, Steve, what did you think of tonight's topic? Is Steve here?
I am, yes, sorry. I found the interview very interesting. I'm very interested in channeling, and I've done quite a lot of channeling myself. And so I know how powerful the information from spirit can be. Mm. And channeling is a wonderful way to access all kinds of philosophy. And, you know, I'm always surprised because I've read very widely for many, many years. And I'm not saying I know it all. I absolutely don't. And I'm sure I'll be learning forever more. But I'm not somebody that has, you know, stayed away from books and philosophy. But when I'm involved with channeling, I'm always just blown away by the fact that the philosophy that comes through, the concepts that are shared by spirit, can be, you know, things that we've really never heard of before. And it just shows you that we can access all kinds of wonderful information. I was sad today thinking about all of the wonderful monuments and relics destroyed in Syria and it was destroyed in Iraq, actually, I think it was, today. And, you know, this is a record of our civilization, and there are books and texts that we'll never see again. But fortunately, we can access spirit, and we can draw down all manner of information. So it was a really great show. I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, so it's a good point you're making about Syria, that I also had enormous grief when the Chinese systematically went in to invade Tibet and no one raised a finger because there's no material gain to be gotten from defending Tibet. And the monasteries were destroyed and the whole religion has pretty much been raped and pillaged. Horrible in the name of war, what we do sometimes to this great information. But you're right, it is a blessing that we can get it back from spirit. So it makes it a little less of a grief issue for me. I'm very curious about your channeling. Do you consider yourself a trance channeler, or are you conscious when you're channeling? And who do you channel? Who do you talk to?
Well, I do both, actually. I do trance channeling. But I also do channeling in a milder form of trance, and I can actually hear what's being said. But I like the phenomena of deep trance channeling because it really is very interesting to see how close spirit can get, because you literally feel a spirit take over your body. You know, you can feel the energy of the spirit drawing very, very close, and you can feel yourself stepping aside, in effect.
Right. And so who do you trance channel, more than one being, or is there one special being that you work with?
Well, I work with my guide Arthur, but there are different entities that can speak. Mm-hmm. And I don't really concern myself with who exactly is speaking.
Right.
I've always been quite strange in that regard. I know of my main guide, Arthur, and I know of him because he gave me his name many, many years ago when I was a kid. So I've always known and recognized him as Arthur. But there are other entities that speak in trance, when I do trance work. And I feel the presence of other guides, other entities that want to speak in consultations or privately. And I don't really feel the need to know exactly who they are and to ask. It's something that's just never been important to me, and maybe a bit strange.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I'm the same way, and I've had people just insist that I need to know who's speaking, and I don't care.
No, I don't. And also, I believe that, you know, you can be receiving a communication from a group of entities. It isn't necessarily one individual walking around with an outfit, you know. So I don't focus too much upon who or what is communicating. I focus more upon what's being said, what's being shared.
I like that. And did you do trance channeling for groups at all, or how do you use it, your channeling?
I have done deep trance channeling in the UK for groups, but I haven't in the US actually, partly because of where I live or the location I'm in. But it is something that I'll be doing more of. I'm going to the UK later this year to participate in a deep trance program. And it's something that I think I'll start doing in the US maybe later this year.
Oh, nice. Very nice. That's very exciting. I like that. And does that fit into your astrology work in some way, the channeling and the astrology? Do they?
Well, do you know what? Actually, it does, because I did some channeling the other day, and I was pretty deep, so I wasn't listening to myself, but I recorded it. And the information I was given about astrology just blew me away. And I've read a lot of astrology books, ancient and recent, but there were concepts that came through that were just light years beyond anything I've read. So that was really exciting. Obviously, spirit know about the validity of astrology, but they know a lot more than we do.
I love that. Do you... aside from recording it, do you write it down? Are you thinking about a book with that? Or
I was thinking that I may at some point put all of the information relating to astrology in a book.
It's
really new material.
Yeah. Excellent. Fabulous. So, okay, I'm not great at banter, so.
Why don't I step in here and pass out the call-in number for us, Dr. Nona Marie? That way people can go ahead and ring us up with their questions.
How's
that sound? Sure. Well, for those of you who have been waiting patiently with your pen and paper, it's time now for the call-in number. The number is 724-444-4851. I'll repeat that. The number is 724-444-4851. Please be aware that every call is going to automatically be placed on hold and will be answered in the order received. So you'll be able to hear the show while you're waiting, so just listen to the banter and pretty soon you'll be on the air. Once you get on the air, we ask you to be as direct as possible with your question. Don't be shy. Will I or won't I? Will it or won't it? We have no problem with those questions. We can only take one of them per person because we'll have a line waiting. Okay, so again, that number is 724-444-4851.
All right, back to you, Dr. Nona Marie. I'm afraid you're going to get past the banter ball, whether you like it or not. Serve.
Oh my God.
Hey, consider it a challenge to tackle, you know, head on.
Oh, I'm so done with challenges. Oh my God.
I mean, it's banter. It's supposed to be frothy and, I don't know, banter-esque.
I know, but I'm not a good chit-chatter like
not a good
that.
So.
Actually, when I was younger, I had to buy a book on small talk, and I used to carry it with me, and in social situations, I would run into the bathroom and flip through it to get some reminders on what to say again. That's how retarded I am about small talk. And
well, the solution is just never to engage in small talk. I mean, just because it's banter doesn't mean it can't be big talk. In fact, it should be big talk. All right.
It should be big talk. I've got no problem with just editing out the, editing out the unimportant stuff and just getting right to the meat of the issue.
Oh, good. Okay.
All right. Besides, I think we pretty soon will have some people coming through the line. You know, lots of folks out there with questions. So just to remind everyone again, the number is 724-444-4851 because we specialize in answering questions. Absolutely.
So I have a question for you, Stephen, or Steve,
sure.
Either one. How did the split between Vedic and Western astrology occur?
It was the age of enlightenment, and I use that term loosely. Kind of widened it, let me just say. Well, a lot of the reason for the split is geographic in nature. A lot of the astrology that came to us through the West, it kind of centralized in Iran. Because of the trade routes, you see. And so a lot of Indian astrology came to the West through Iran. And a lot of Western astrology, a lot of people don't know this, went to India through Iran as well. Now, the Indians fudged a lot of their stuff from the Chinese, the antiquity of whose tradition actually is greater than either Western or Vedic astrology.
That's interesting. So Chinese astrology is quite different than even Vedic astrology?
Absolutely. There are some similarities, of course. I mean, Chinese astrology is by no means what you see in the typical placemat in the, you know, Chinese buffet. You know what I'm saying? It's right. Not that's not Chinese astrology. That's something that you look at when you're waiting for your Mugu Gaipan or what have you.
Right.
Chinese astrology is obviously quite complex. And it's, again, it's, it dates back to the deepest antiquity. The Chinese emperors were very interested in the movements of the planets, and they correlated those movements with things like crop yields and wars and meteorological phenomena and natural things like floods and all sorts of stuff. So they left us records of a very well-developed astrology, and a lot of it got shunted over to the West via the Indians through Iran. And of course, there is a huge divergence too. The irony is that the farther back you go to study Western astrology, then the similarities between the West and the East become a lot tighter. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that traditional European astrology isn't really all that much radically different from modern Vedic astrology at all.
Wow.
The only thing that changes is the nomenclature, the terminology.
Huh. Are there any really good books on Chinese astrology that you know of that are, you know, not silly like the placemat?
Well, the quest for good books that aren't of the placemat variety, that's kind of an elusive bird of paradise. Mm-hmm. And most people avoid those books for a few reasons. Reason number one is because they're expensive as all get out. People foolishly shun the best books because of their price. I've never understood that, because the price of not reading the book is obviously incalculably greater than forking over to read the book. And second of all, the material's kind of recondite and boring, for lack of a better term. Unfortunately, we've spent several decades allowing our intellectual capacity, our capacity to imagine, we've allowed that to atrophy, because we don't have to imagine things. The television imagines it for us. You see what I mean? So the capacity to use this feature has atrophied, and, you know, for this reason, the material that's not of placemat variety quality is that much more distant from us, unfortunately. It's a situation where we can lead the thirsting man to the creek, and still he will not drink.
Right. Hmm. I actually had there's a Taoist sorcerer, and a series of books was published. It's called Opening the Dragon's Gate, 18th Generation of Taoist Wizardry. And this man managed to, he was initiated into this Taoist sorcery path. It's sort of like a Chinese version of the Carlos Castaneda's books. Quite fantastic stories, and he managed to survive in the mountains during the Maoist era and not get killed. And he is now teaching in Beijing, and he had a protege that was out here in California who barely spoke English and did a chart for me in Mandarin, I believe. And I can't get any more detail about it because I haven't met anybody who can translate Mandarin. In Southern California, you think I'd be able to find it. And the ones who can understand Mandarin don't understand the chart. And it is indeed quite different. It reminded me a little bit more of numerology in the way the cycles, he laid out the cycles. And it was all around the elements of wood and metal and air and fire and those things. So
fortunately, you can get by easily, handily, with the I Ching. You know, the Chinese astrology was never intended for the rustics. They never, in other words, they didn't think that you and I, our lives were important enough to merit any mention in the stars. You see what I mean? So there was not the astrology that we would recognize. It wasn't something that propagated to the masses. It persisted that way into Babylon as well at first, with the Baru priests and the Babylonian priestly hierarchy. In their opinion, astrology was not meant for the common person, and it wasn't until roughly the time of Christ that astrology evolved into natal astrology, where, you know, people like normal people started getting studied.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. So it was kind of an upper class tool.
Important class. You know, even the upper class were deemed you know, their lives had enough force, I guess, to deserve being mentioned in the stars. Of course, we don't believe these things today, fortunately. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't. Otherwise, astrology for the commoner wouldn't work. But there is a certain merit to the idea that, you know, for example, you know, if a pauper comes to me and he has signs of extreme wealth in his natal chart, you know, I would interpret that as relative to his social class, extreme wealth in a pauper level. You know what I mean? That would be right. One always has to be balanced in the analysis, and you know, it's interesting to do, and it's
interesting.
It is. I personally think that you have to consider not only the person's natal chart, but also the other dominant mundane charts, so to fit that person into the society that he or she lives in. Do you know what I mean? That society might have wars, economic depressions and recessions, various fads of different sorts. And so that's always going to work inexorably upon the person. Mm-hmm. It could be that you were born with the most fortunate natal chart in the whole planet. But if you happen to be born during a period of disaster and strife in humanity in general, then that good fortune might just mean that you survived the initial apocalyptic wave and, you know, you can live out the remainder of your days in an underground bunker eating spam. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So,
well, guys, we actually have some callers right now.
Yeah,
there's a caller from South Dakota for me. I'll be taking this one. Who's calling from South Dakota?
Hi. Yes, this is Jeannie.
Hello, Jeannie. How can we help you?
Well, I have had for the last two or three days a sense of I need to be moving in a certain direction because I've been sort of agitated.
Okay.
And I'm trying to figure out what is my body or somebody trying to tell me.
Well, I feel, Jeannie, that there is a need for change. There is a need for you to really step into your true self. You know, I feel that you've had quite a number of disruptions in your life, quite a number of significant disruptions, I would say. And you are a quite loving person. You are one of these people that generally tries to put other people first. And you know, that's all well and good, but it can cause a person to compromise themselves. So I feel as though this is a theme with you, Jeannie, and I feel that it's time for you to put yourself first. It's time for you to do what is right for yourself. And I feel that this is a time for you to really be clear with yourself about your life, your path, what you want. And particularly, I feel like you need to have far more fun. I feel like life has become quite serious for you, and this is a challenge. So I honestly want to say to you as well that I feel that you'll move, Jeannie. I feel that you need to be in a different environment. So I feel that you'll actually change your home. I'm not saying that you'll necessarily, you know, move to the other side of the country or something like that, but I feel that you'll change your environment. I feel that you'll reorganize your life so that it's easier for you, it's simpler for you, so that you don't have as many stresses and responsibilities. And particularly, I feel as though there have been financial stresses and responsibilities that have burdened you, that have stopped you from doing what you want to do, that have stopped you from your spiritual and psychic development, that sort of got in the way. So these are the things that I feel for you. I do feel that you've got good friends. I feel that you should lean on your friends and the people that you can count on. But as I said, it's a time of change, Jeannie. And if you pursue your path, if you pursue what's important to you, I feel that later in the year you'll feel much more settled, much less stressed, just much happier within yourself. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. I mean, I understand intellectually what you're saying. I'll just have to figure out what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I feel, honestly, I feel that there's stress related to your home life. And I feel that there's a relationship, or there are relationships that are stressful. And I feel that the two combined really disrupt you, really disrupt your balance. And so I feel that those are the main two things for you to address, Jeannie. And as I said, I feel that you'll move. And I also feel that once you do move, you'll feel far more at peace, far more balanced, and life will be much better for you. You are somebody that thinks a lot as well. I mean, you're really somebody that has a mind that's constantly churning, and you can trust your intuition. You're an intuitive person, but you tend to be very stuck in the mind of thoughts and analysis. And I feel like you need to step back from that a little bit. You are an intelligent lady, but remember that the mind is a tool. It shouldn't be driving you. It should be serving you or working for you. And you tend to be very much consumed by your thoughts. So try to relax a little. Try to switch off a little more. And consider home life, family commitments, relationship. Okay?
Okay, I will. And thank you so very, very much.
My pleasure, Jeannie. Good luck to you. We wish you the best.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. And thank you, Steve, for that reading. You can find Steve at psychicaccess.com. Now, I have a caller from Missouri. Hello. How are you, Missouri?
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
It's my pleasure. How may I help you?
Well, my question is, I would like to know what specifically would be my next step professionally towards fulfilling my purpose and having complete abundance and prosperity in the process.
Okay, that's a very good question. One second while I try to pick up on an answer for that question, okay?
Thank you, Yes. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am, my pleasure. You know what? What I'm really picking up on is that the time of, like, sacrificing to get there is over with. You know what I mean? So what that means, as far as I'm thinking, is that you can go ahead and automatically turn your back on things like courses and other things that you might have to pay for in order to better yourself or other things like that. There aren't really any more sacrifices you have to make. And also, it's very important for me to pass along to you that there's no reason to delay or to suspend your progress. In other words, there's nothing that should be blocking you or getting in the way of your path. Now, as far as what's going to lead you there, to that place where you're not only enjoying some material abundance, but also, as you said, fulfilling your function. Well, there are a couple of energies I'm picking up on here that will lead you there. First of all is the energy of analysis and labor, and also the energy of silence as well. What this is telling me is that while you shouldn't be perhaps paying for courses, that still doesn't mean that you shouldn't be studying and analyzing things to advance yourself. It's calling for a bit of a, I think what's called for here is for you to kind of cloister yourself away a little bit socially and convert some of that time into some sort of self-improvement development program. And you know, that could be intellectual, physical, spiritual, or a combination of all three. You know, in other words, you don't want to get rid of, you know, all of the structures and long-standing things in your life. However, it's going to be time to contract a little bit and kind of, I guess, be a little bit cold and turn your vision away from all of the other things that are in your life. And again, analysis, things that are practical and analytical are going to be what bring you to the material abundance. So now is the time to jettison any dreams of being the next American Idol. What's called for now is cold, calculated reality. Can you agree with me on that one?
It's been cold, calculated reality for a couple of years.
I don't mean as far as what you're experiencing. You know, and if you're not harboring any unrealistic expectations as far as your profession is concerned, you know, then that's fine. You're going on the right direction because that's what's called for now. So,
okay.
You know, first of all, I also think that you are on track. You're doing the right things. I also believe that you're going to be due for some accomplishment and satisfaction in your career. If you do perceive of any drags on your advancement, they could be just related to the larger economy. And as soon as those larger macroeconomic factors are relaxed a little bit, you know, then you'll surge forth. You know, in other words, what might be called for now is just a little bit of patience, because I think that you're just right there on the threshold of a breakthrough moment. I really do. I don't think you're going to be delayed here pretty soon. I think you're going to, going forward in the next couple of months even, I do believe that the pace of your professional life will kind of accelerate a little bit. And I think you're going to be fortunate as well.
What do you see me doing? I mean, do you see, like, what is it that I'm doing that's just, I can't.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking for, that step. I mean, because it's like for the last couple of years, I've been following intuition, guidance, you know, everything to do all of that. And I'm just like really frustrated, and it's just, right. What is it? Because I normally don't go outside of myself, and I literally divinely came across this program, and I would literally said, I'm going outside of myself because I can't figure this out. And it's just beyond frustration, you know?
How do you feel about the idea of partnering up with someone similar to yourself? Do you know what I mean? Like someone who is also at a similar level, kind of learning or trying to assimilate this new information. How do you feel about that? I think that would be very helpful.
I'm open to any and all possibilities.
Let me explain a little bit of the logic why.
What is it that I'm not hearing or seeing, or, you know, that's why I was just like, maybe, so, you know, sometimes when you're too close to something, that's when just somebody else can just shine a little bit of a light. And that's what I was looking for, because it's like, it just seems like a closed door, a closed door, a closed door, a closed door. And every time, and I'm just like, oh my goodness, you know, and I'm just perplexed beyond belief.
Well, I think that we have actually stumbled on something that will help us here. Because the reason I based my idea, hey, why not get a partner, is because, you know, I'm using tarot here, and the card summarizing this situation is the reversed queen of the earth element, okay? Now, that confused me, because the reversed queen is a male, and I'm talking to a female. So I assumed this card is an emblem for yourself. But then I started thinking about it, because this particular card is associated with the sign of Virgo. Virgo is mutable, it's multi-bodied, it's numerous. And so now it seems very apparent to me that partnering up with, and it'll probably be a male, you know, just because of the dynamics of the card. Maybe you would learn better if you had a partner student who were, I don't know, but certainly finding a partner to go into with this would be I think one of the necessary keys. Of course, the other issue is the Knight of the Air element reversed. That gives a little bit more information as to what you should positively do. And you know, that card, what it's blatantly saying is that you should be very critical about your money supply. But that doesn't make sense to me, because you already are critical about your money supply. Maybe it's saying that you need to start being critical of it in terms of looking where it goes. That you know, one key to having material abundance is to start managing your cash flows that you have now a little bit better. Do you know what I mean? In other words, maybe there's a drain on your cash flow that you're not aware of. Perhaps you have a Netflix account that keeps debiting your bank, you know, every single month or something. So I think that might be an issue that you need to keep in mind as well. You know what I mean?
Yes. Okay,
yeah. Fortunately, I do really think that you are on the threshold here, and having somebody to bounce some ideas off of, who is also into this. I don't know what this area of endeavor is, but I think having a partner right here is going to be important to help you to get you up out of the student levels and into a level where, you know, you can bounce questions off each other. You can learn from each other, you know?
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Best of luck to you, okay?
Thank you. Thank you. Namaste. Right.
Yes, ma'am. We have a caller now from Michigan for Dr. Nona Marie Foyer.
Hello, Michigan. Are you there?
Hi, Nona. It's Liz. I've spoke to you before. I don't know if you remember.
Hi. Yes. What can I do for you?
Hi. I was just a little frustrated with psychic development, and I was just wondering if I'm making any progress.
I would actually, if you could, are you taking or trying to do any kind of channeling work?
No. I mean, I've sat down and tried maybe like some automatic writing just to see what came about, but
yeah,
nothing.
It does feel to me that there's a little bit of it's almost like I want to say trying too hard, but it's not really quite like that. It does feel to me like there's someone in spirit in the background trying to get through you, through to other people through you, that channeling is something that is open to you right now, even more so than the psychic work. And it's something there about you being able to access deeper messages than sometimes is asked from psychics. Sometimes psychics, people want just very mechanical kind of answers. I would, if I were you, look for a channeling group right now to find a safe place for you to be able to practice without a lot of interference. And if you look on Meetup on the internet, which is a free listing of local groups, almost always you can find something like that now on Meetup. And the cost to join a group like that is usually very, very inexpensive. And it's usually people offering service rather than business trying to make a lot of money. So I would look on there for a channeling group, because it feels like you need a place that has a little more psychic protection for you, kind of like for this energy that's and this spirit that is hanging around you very heavily right now, for that spirit to come out.
Like negative?
No, good. Very good.
Oh, good.
It's almost though, a little bit like there's like a slight disconnect. There's a spirit that wants to come through you, but you're using some other channels in your brain for your psychic development. And what you really need more is to just kind of let go. And sometimes it's easier to let go when there's some people supporting us. In other words, it's the same thing when sometimes people are trying to learn how to meditate. They do much better meditating in a group. The combined energy somehow helps us to feel safer. The energies get enhanced, and we're able to release more than we can by ourselves at different times. Sometimes meditating by ourselves is more powerful. But it does feel to me like right now what would help you most is being somewhere really safe for you to completely open up and allow another energy to come through you to help you with your development. Worst case, if you cannot find a group that's doing this, that does stuff that teaches people how to channel, and usually there is a channeler there, and then they take you into kind of a very deep meditation and then just ask you to speak from whatever's coming out of you. And that's pretty simple work to do, but it's very intense energetically. If for some reason
would it
you cannot
scare me
find
if I did it by
like
myself?
That. What's that?
Would it scare me if I did it by myself? I just have a hard time getting to meet up because I have kids and I work full time and I'm so busy.
I understand. It's not so much that it would scare you as it's just a little difficult for you. So let me tell you some other alternatives that I think you could do. One is making a circle with crystals. If you have crystals in the house that you work with, quartz crystals, if you make a circle and raise up a circle, in other words, use them, ask for guidance, ask for protection, that would be another way for you to work. In other words, to not just work in a room where you've thrown up shields, but the energy of quartz crystals really, really enhances energies when you're doing this kind of work. Another thing that you could do, I used to do this when I was younger, is go to a church that has a huge appeal to you. Go there when it's empty and sit in the pews and in there meditate and ask for guidance and ask for help in your development. Because right now it does feel like there is a part of you, I don't want to say that you're blocked or holding back, because it's not really like that. It's almost like you don't know what it feels like yet. So until you know what it feels like, you can't quite let go enough in the right direction. It's almost like if you were learning to ride a horse and they talk to you about how to move your hips and you don't know how to do it, and you can't get it, and then somebody just jumps on the horse behind you. Now you feel safe, and all of a sudden you know how to do it. because you just feel really safe. So it's more like that than saying you're blocked or you can't let go, because it's not really that. It's just more like you're looking for the wrong sensation is the best thing way I can describe it. So if you can't find a channeler, a channeling group to teach you that, I would work with quartz crystals. If you can't do that, I would then, as a final solution, is go out in nature and say, ask for help, say a prayer, ask for help, ask for guidance. And I believe that you will be drawn either to a very large rock, like a boulder, or a tree, but I think it's going to be a boulder that you can go and sit and meditate with that energy that will ground you enough to allow a bigger opening to happen. So you're right on the edge. So I would say don't get frustrated and don't get discouraged either. When this cracks open for you, you'll almost laugh at how simple it is. But right now you're just kind of teetering on this edge, and there's just a little tiny bit of disconnect here for you. Part of it also is that you are so stretched thin in your life right now. That's another reason why something more supportive will help you make this breakthrough. It's not like you have a lot of breathing space in your life. And when we're like that, when we're stretched that thin, it is hard at times to make that first breakthrough. When we get used to having that development up and running, we can usually call up that energy, you know, in the middle of a traffic jam. But in the beginning, it's not that familiar. It's not that easy to always do that for some of us. Some people from birth, they can do that. But so overall, it does feel to me like you're right on the edge of that, and you should not be so frustrated. You get very, very impatient with yourself in all aspects of your life. You have massively high expectations of yourself. And I would say that overall, you're doing incredible work in your life, and not to push so hard. And there's no race and there's no rush, and you don't have to be first because there's no race. So I would say also, if you can ease up on pushing yourself, take it easy once in a while. Have fun. When we have fun, it literally bolsters our immune system. It changes our brain chemistry, and it allows a lot of other energies to come in. So that's part of what's going on as well, too, is that you're just so hard on yourself and you're pushing a lot. And I know you feel you have to. To me, you have this sense almost like if you stop for a second, the avalanche will catch up with you and run you over. But I can say to you that I feel very strong guidance around you and a lot of protection. And if you slow down a little bit, those protections will kick in and keep your life very manageable.
Okay, good. Good. So, I know, so, and I feel like I just got a letter that I got accepted to the grad school I wanted to go to, and I was just like, oh my God, how am I going to do this?
Right.
I guess I'll figure it out when I have to.
Well, and ask for help. That's the other thing. When we are doing psychic development work, one of the things we want to do is start learning to live in harmony and in partnership with those energies. We don't want to run our life ourselves and then call on psychic energy to find a parking space. If anything, we want to do the opposite. Let us find the parking space ourselves, and we call on spirit to help us on every single thing in our life. So with graduate school and with all that pressure, I'd be praying for guidance. And then sit in a small meditation and allow that to come through. So that's part of it also, is that you have so much pride about not leaning on people, not being dependent, not being helpless, you know, being competent. And again, ease up on yourself. You're doing great. You're doing great. And more fun, a little more relaxation, the avalanche will not catch up with you. It will not. Your guides will hold it at bay. And you will be able to go along in a more balanced fashion. And then you'll be able to have this psychic energy come in and help you more in your daily life. So give that a shot. Give that a shot. And look on Meetup. It's spelled M-E-E-T-U-P. And you don't have to pay any money to look and join or anything like that. And the groups always announce how much they charge. And usually you can find somebody there.
Okay. And will I know it when it happens?
You will. You will. Absolutely. There is help out there for you. You're just so darn independent. Sometimes you forget to ask for help.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, sweetheart.
Really
thanks for calling
it.
In.
What was that?
I said you're welcome, and thank you for calling in.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Stay in touch.
Okay, well.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you very much for calling. Big thank you to Dr. Nona Marie Foyer. You can find her at psychicaccess.com. And that brings us to the end of yet another wonderful show, our final show for now. We'll be back in the summer, early autumn. I'd like to thank Doug Christman for helping us, working behind the scenes always, keeping us on track as our executive producer.